The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jonathan Boyarin, one of the most prominent Judaic studies professors and authors today, a scholar of Jewish identity in the 21st century. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg Letterman, visiting correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond, and storyteller Jordan Hill. Tom Price, our international expert, is on medical leave for a couple of weeks. We wish Tom a speedy recovery. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. A great deal has been made of the shocking defeat of the Democratic senatorial candidate in Massachusetts, Martha Coakley, at the hands of a handsome, down-to-earth Republican, Scott Brown. People are seeing it as a sign that the Democrats are in big trouble, that they now have lost their supermajority in the Senate. Not being Democrats, that it was doing them much good anyway, since they never agree on anything as a party. I'm reminded of Will Rogers' famous line, "I belong to no organized political party. I am a Democrat." In any case, lots of reasons are being given for the loss of a seat that had been Democratic for 50 years and more, the seat that Ted Kennedy held forever. The Democrats are too liberal, people say. The people are angry with everything. Government is going to take a lot of heat in these troubled times. Martha Coakley ran a bad campaign. Healthcare reform is a bad idea, and all people hate it. Too many people are out of work. Government is too big, and so on. Well, I think the truth is quite different. I think the problem is that the Democratic candidate in Massachusetts wasn't Jewish, or at least partly Jewish. You see, Jewish candidates for the Senate do preposterously well. We Jews represent at most 1.5% of the population of America. That logically would mean we should have one or two Jewish senators, since there are 100 senators. But in point of fact, there are some 14 clearly Jewish senators, and a couple of others with a Jewish parent who kind of identify as Jews. That means that Jewish candidates for the Senate get elected at roughly 10 times the rate we should. If only the Massachusetts Democratic machine, failing to find an appropriate Kennedy to put up for office, had just run a Jewish candidate, they would have had a vastly better chance to win. Face it, we just make better senatorial candidates than non-Jews. And that's not counting the Jewishly descended senators, who aren't counted here, like John Kerry. For the record, the Jews in the Senate are Arlen Specter, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Russ Feingold, Herb Kohl, Carl Levin, Joe Lieberman, Bernie Sanders, Al Franken, Chuck Schumer, Ben Cardin, Ron Wyden, Frank Lautenberg, and, well, Michael Bennett maybe. His mother was a Holocaust survivor hidden as a child in Poland. His dad is a Christian, and he's kind of vague about his affiliation. By the way, that list does not include Ted Kaufman of Maryland, whose dad is Jewish, but he himself is Roman Catholic. In any case, I contend that with a Jewish candidate in Massachusetts, the Democrats would have held this seat easily. Next time, maybe they'll listen to the great political wisdom of Too Jewish. Jewish identity is an important part of our agenda here at Too Jewish in a silly way, but a serious one, too. In a very different sphere of endeavor, I had the chance to hear Art Garfunkel in concert with the Tucson Symphony Orchestra last week. Gotta tell you, at the age of 67, he still sounds great. And when he sang Bridge Over Troubled Waters with the full symphony, it was spectacular. I have loved Simon and Garfunkel's music since the 1960s when I was a wee child, and I still do. But at some level or another, I wish those guys would make some form of positive Jewish identification. After all, two Jewish boys from Queens shouldn't only be singing about Jesus loves you more than you will know, with nary a mention of anything about their own religious tradition. Perhaps I'm just peeved because Art Garfunkel wouldn't give us a two Jewish interview. Or maybe I just need a friend. If you need a friend, I'm assuming, of course, that you know that Simon and Garfunkel are both Jewish. I mean, just look at them. Boy, there were, well, no, don't let me get started on how many Jewish folk and rock singers there are out there. When we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our guest this morning, Professor Jonathan Boyarin, one of the most important Jewish academics at work today, who'll explain what Jewish identity really is, right here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I'm Edmund Marquez with the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency. When was the last time you had a moment of truth with your auto or home insurance and needed your agent to make a claim? While we all hope we'll never need to use our auto or home insurance, if you do have something unexpected happen, would you rather call a 1-800 number or a friend who you can trust to see your claim through? My family has been helping Tucsonans navigate claims and protect their assets for over 40 years. Don't call an anonymous customer service agent. Call Edmund Marquez with the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency for a personal touch and a reassuring helping hand. Stop by and see me at the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency on Speedway just west of Swan, or call us at 323-9333.
The premier Jewish educational event in Southern Arizona is coming to Temple Emmanuel next week. Professor Jonathan Boyarin, Distinguished Professor of Jewish Thought at the University of North Carolina, will present the 2010 Rabbi Albert T. Bill Gray Lectureship Series at Temple Emmanuel and the University of Arizona from Thursday, January 28th through Sunday, January 30th. Dr. Boyarin will explore Jewish identity and the kaleidoscope of generations. On Thursday, January 28th at 7:30 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Dr. Boyarin will speak on the anthropology of Judaism. On Friday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m., he'll speak at Temple Emmanuel on Jewishness and the Kaleidoscope of Generations. Saturday, January 30th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch, he'll explore Hasidic modernity, radical introspection, and Jewish belief. Call 327-4501 for information on all three presentations. All the events in this terrific Temple Emmanuel Rabbi Albert T. Bill Gray Lectureship are free and open to the public, except the dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information and to find out more about Arizona's first synagogue. That's 327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish Professor Jonathan Boyarin. He's the Leonard and Toby Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Modern Jewish Thought at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Dr. Boyarin is an anthropologist and a lawyer. He served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University in Dartmouth, came to Carolina from the University of Kansas, where he was Distinguished Professor of Modern Jewish Studies, got his J.D. from Yale Law School in 1998, his Ph.D. in Anthropology at the New School for Social Research in New York in 1984. His books, including From a Ruined Garden, his first book, The Memorial Books of Polish Jewry, Polish Jews in Paris, The Ethnography of Memory, The Storm from Paradise, The Politics of Jewish Memory, and Thinking in Jewish, and he's edited other books as well with his brother Daniel Boyarin. He co-edited Jews and Other Differences, The New Jewish Cultural Studies, one of the most prominent, I guess, analysts of Jewish culture at work today, and has also had some controversial positions. And after all of that, how do you feel hearing all of that?
Tired. Tired and relieved.
Would your mother approve?
Oh, my mother's thrilled. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. My father, Olav Shalom, knew as he was fading about 4 or 5 years ago that Kansas was important somehow. I knew I had the job at Kansas then, but hadn't quite taken it up.
Tell me what has changed in the way people think about, I tell you, even more simply, how would you define ethnography?
The core of ethnography, which is usually but not necessarily done by people who are called anthropologists, is I'll put it real simply, community study or participant observation, finding a reasonably well-defined social and cultural group, getting in there and spending time with them, doing some of the things they do, trying to think and talk some of the ways they do, and occupy that intermediate space between insider and outsider.
You know, it's interesting to say that because Jews have been seen as the classic outsiders in culture. And you study some of those sort of outsider experiences, even in places where Jews had been for 1,000 years and more. Do you think Jews in America are outsiders or insiders today?
I think that we're as American as anybody else. I think that some of the very rich studies in American Jewish cultural studies and studies in popular culture in the past decades have, among other things, not just shown what Jews have contributed to American culture, but how ideas expressed by Jews and even models from Jewish cultural identity have shaped American notions of identity and difference more generally.
Fascinating subject. We'll take it up more generally also with Jonathan Boyarin, our guest this morning on Too Jewish, when we come back in just a few moments.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times, from their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce. You are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's Too Jewish Radio. Or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. This coming weekend, we will celebrate Tu B'Shvat, the Jewish New Year for trees. It's kind of a Semitic Arbor Day. The Mishnah, codified in the year 225, roughly 1,800 years ago, tells us there are 4 New Years every single year. New Year for princes, a New Year for taxes, a New Year for judgment, Rosh Hashanah, and a New Year for trees. When the sap begins to flow in the spring and trees come to life, it's time to celebrate Tu B'Shvat, literally the 15th day of the Jewish calendar month of Shvat. We're supposed to eat a variety of fruits and nuts, products of trees, and thank God for the goodness and vitality of the natural world. It's a very green holiday, and it's customary to eat from the 7 species that grow natively in the land of Israel: figs, olives, dates, grapes, pomegranates, wheat, and barley. This is a festival designed to connect us to nature, to help us rejoice in the beauty of the land and the graciousness of God. in the holy city of Tzfat in the north of Israel. We'll be visiting there on our Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip this summer. It became customary to hold a Seder, kind of like the one we do on Passover, on this holiday of Tu B'Shvat, to drink four cups of wine as we do on Pesach, only this time they symbolize the four seasons of the year rather than God's promises of freedom. We use white wine to symbolize winter, blush wine for spring, light red for summer, and dark red for fall. All of this is a way to remind ourselves that the natural world is a gift from God. We have every reason to appreciate it at this time of year, when the sap begins to flow in the trees and the earth gets ready for a new cycle of growth and rebirth. There's a nice confluence in our Jewish rituals this weekend. We celebrate Tu B'Shvat Friday and Saturday, and it happens to fall directly on Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, when we read the Torah portion of B'Shalach, celebrating our exodus from Egypt and escape on the shore of the Sea of Reeds from the Egyptians. So the two great Seders in Jewish tradition, the one for Passover and, of course, Tu B'Shvat, are linked on our calendar this Friday and Saturday. Nice way to celebrate the rebirth of life in this not very harsh winter season in southern Arizona. Now, if you are podcasting Too Jewish in the more frigid parts of our country, and this year they are frigid, this will have even more meaning for you, because spring is coming soon, and Tu B'Shvat and Shabbat Shirah are harbingers of warmer times to come. Rabbi David Wilfon, the first Reform rabbi to serve in the former Soviet Union, has been treating us to some fabulous stories about the rebirth of Jewish life there. He's back with another in this great short series, this one about Passover, perfectly appropriate holiday to talk about when we read that Torah portion of B'Shalach this week, and another great tale of the revival of contemporary Jewish life in the Ukraine.
Did you do Pesach in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union?
Let me tell you about it. You know, in America, or in most of the Jewish world, Passover is just like we do the Seder the first night or the second night. In Russia, there's lots of communities that don't have Jewish education and they're insecure. And they'll do a Seder any night of the Passover week that a rabbi comes to visit.
True.
So I would get on the train.
Even true in America. I mean, there's places where that happens.
I would get on the train and each night go to a different city and lead a Passover Seder the whole week. So I'm doing like eight Seders all week long.
That's enough Pesach for anyone.
So one time I get a phone call. I'm actually still in Jerusalem. And I get a phone call. Rabbi, we need somebody in Baranovich to lead a Seder. Would you come to Baranovich? And I'm thinking, Baranovich? I've heard the name of that town before. I wonder from where. And I think about it. And then I say to myself, hey, I think one of my rabbis in rabbinical school, Wacholder,
Rabbi Benzion Wacholder, remarkable teacher.
I think he went to the yeshiva in Baranovich. So I call him up on the phone and say, Rabbi Wacholder, does the name Baranovich mean anything to you? And he says, yes, that's my yeshiva. And I said, well, listen, they called me up to come lead a Passover Seder. And he says, well, you have to take pictures. And I said, excuse me, Dr. Wacholder, and here I have to set aside.
It's Yontif.
Well, not that it's Yontif, but your listeners may not know this. Dr. Wacholder had been blind for about 30 years.
Long time.
So to have a blind man ask you to take photographs, I thought was like weird. So I said, excuse me, Dr. Wacholder, but why do you want me to take photographs? And he said, it's not for me. He didn't say stupid, but that's what was implied. It's not for me. It's for my grandchildren. I'd be grateful if you could take pictures for them.
So he can show them where he went to yeshiva.
So I go to Baranovich. When I get there, I'm met by an older woman who gives us a tour of the community. And I say, is there a yeshiva building here? And she says, yeah, the yeshiva was not destroyed during the war. The building still exists. We walk over to the building. It's now a sports college. So it's kind of interesting. A place was for spiritual learning. It's now for phys ed. The building's still there. That night, we have the Seder, and there's about 100 or so people in the Seder. And when I first get to the building, nobody yet is there, just like my host, and I see there's an ark and a Torah scroll in the corner. And so I ask her, so you guys got a Torah? That's amazing. She said it actually survived the war. It was hidden by a family. It was then given back to the community. It was like in their closet. But nobody here knows how to read it. We just have it. It's like a good luck charm. We don't really know how to use it. So in the middle of the Seder, I did something very unorthodox. There's one part of the Passover Seder where we actually read a quote from the Torah. With an outstretched arm, I brought you out of the land of Egypt. So what I did is we opened up the ark, we took out the Torah scroll, and we walked through the crowd of the 100 or so people. Everybody stood up. And then we opened up the Torah scroll in the middle of the Seder, and I read for them in Hebrew and translated to them those particular verses. When the Seder was, just felt really cool to use their Torah. When the Seder was over, I said to them, listen, I taught you lots of teachings about the Seder, commentaries, interpretations. I have to tell you that I didn't actually make this stuff up. Most of it I was taught in rabbinical school and by one rabbi in particular. His name was Ben Sion Wacholder, and Rabbi Wacholder actually went to yeshiva in this city before the war. So tonight, the things that I'm telling you, I'm returning to you the Torah of Baranovich. Please remember these teachings. Don't forget them. Tell them to your children. Tell them to your neighbors, not just this year, but next year and the following year, so that the Torah of Baranovich will be restored and will not be lost. And I had this feeling, and I'll stop with this. Sometimes you get a feeling, maybe for this I was created. Maybe for this I was born. The idea that I could carry the teachings from my rabbi about Passover, who learned it in this town, taught it to me in Cincinnati, and then take it back to that town and bring it to life again for them. I felt like an incredible, privileged moment to be like a link in that chain of reconnection, recreating the circuit of Jewish teaching and life.
Thanks, Gingy, for a wonderful story. We'll get a final installment next week. We welcome our Mavinta, our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Lenrin. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And I know this sounds strange, but Happy New Year. It's the Happy New Year for trees.
So many New Years, so little time.
Indeed.
That should be the Jewish motto.
The Mishnah tells us there's four New Years. That doesn't count January 1st, of course. One of them, Tu B'Shvat, the New Year for Trees, coming up this Friday and Saturday. We celebrate with a big wine-tasting Seder and lots of agricultural and particularly ecological themes at my temple. Tell me about Tu B'Shvat as a moral force.
Well, you know, it's I love how Judaism, from really the beginning of time, both liturgically and through the calendar, has embraced the issues that were relevant during the day being thousands of years ago, that are still so relevant. I mean, Tu B'Shvat, we could say, is the holiday that lets us know that Judaism is, in fact, green, and always has been. You know, the whole idea of trees being sacred objects, many metaphors we can, you know, borrow from, of course, Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, being the Torah. The beautiful quote from the Talmud about, you know, before I came into the world, my parents planted for me, and so now I plant for those who come after me.
Right.
The notion that we stop, you know, we would stop everything except the planting of a tree if we were told that the Messiah was here, all suggests that we treat trees as sacred living objects, and as part of creation. And I think the important thing that we forget when we look at the Jewish tradition is that we have had a concept that has been very, very environmentally sensitive and sacred, which is Baal Tashchit, which is from the Torah, from the very beginning of time, when Jews were to be successful, be victorious in a war, we were prohibited from cutting down the fruit trees of the lands of our the people that we conquered. And, of course, the reason for that is because, first of all, there's this sense that fruit trees will provide nourishment and food for future generations. That's a practical reason. But the deeper reason, the psychological reason, the spiritual reason, is that at our most perhaps powerful time, when we have vanquished our foe and we're literally on top of the world, so to speak, we are told and we're prohibited from just acting upon the land and acting upon the area that we've conquered without some kind of restraint. And that's to remind us that we still always have a higher authority, that even when we have achieved, you know, greatness and victory, we're still really always aware of the fact that there is someone, something much larger than just our own individual or communal needs, governing us, guiding us. And, of course, that's God and the Torah. And so, you know, we treat trees as living things, but we also treat them as reminders of our place and placement in the universe. And I think that's just a lovely and very ancient idea.
Wonderful idea, and a great way to say Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Tu B'Shvat.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Thanks, Amy. When we come back, we'll hear from storyteller Jordan Hill and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with a great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant and the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
All right. If you had to choose between your children, Janos and the J Bar, not Ben, which restaurant would you choose?
Okay. I think if I wanted a casual night out, then I would go to J Bar, where we've got that great pan Latin cooking, the terrific mojitos and margaritas. You can sit outside overlooking the valley. That's great for a casual night out. If I wanted a more serious and just, you know, really special, special night, that's Janos, where all the great foods of the region, but with our French cooking techniques, a really sophisticated cuisine and just perfect spot-on service in a beautiful setting. I guess that's for the serious and really special night out.
And, you know, this might be a special night for you tonight, huh?
Well, I hope so.
The number to call for Janos and the J-Bar is
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com.
That's JANOS.com. I'll see you there.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bobby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Max was crossing the street one day and he was hit by a bus. Immediately rushed to the hospital, he was put in intensive care. A few days later, Harry, his best friend, visits him. "So, how are things, Max?" Harry asks. "Not good," says Max. "My wife, Leah, visits me 3 times a day. "What's so bad about that?" says Harry. "Every time she comes," says Max, "she sits in my bedside and reads to me." "Well, what's wrong with that?" says Harry. "What does she read?" And Max says, "My life insurance policy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live, and please be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. So going with this theme of the last couple of weeks of death in the middle of these winter days, I wanted to tell one more story on that theme, and this goes as such. There was a tradition at some points in Israel, that when you were walking around the marketplace in Eilat, you could sometimes see Lady Death, the angel of death, waiting there. They said that she was tall and slender, cloaked in shadows and darkness. And if you happened to see her, well, it was not your lucky day. Because if she spoke to you, if she said something to you, then you knew that she was after you and you did not have long, if any time at all, to live. And it happened that one day a servant was going through the marketplace, buying and haggling over a bunch of pomegranates at this one stall that he was buying for his master. And as he was sitting there arguing, he looked through the open side of the stall, and who should he see standing there but the angel of death herself, cloaked in darkness, tall and slender, and she was seemingly staring right at him. And she raised a bony finger towards him, bringing it towards her lips as if she was about to speak. But before she had a chance, the servant threw down the basket of pomegranates, and he went running from the marketplace all the way back to his master. And as soon as he got there, he said, "Master, please, please, can I borrow one of your horses? I need to get to the town of Arad." And the master said, "Of course you can, but what's the matter?" And he said, "In the marketplace, I saw Lady Death, and she pointed at me. She was about to speak to me. Please, I know if I can get to Arad, I have a cousin there. He can take care of me, and I can possibly escape the clutches of the angel of death." And the master said, "By all means, take my fastest horse. You know where it is." And so the servant jumped on the back of this horse. And as he was riding off, again, the master called out and said, "You're sure you'll be safe?" And the servant said, "Of course, I will be in Arad if you need me." And as he went riding off, the master thought to himself, You know, perhaps Lady Death, the Angel of Death, will be upset that he escaped, and maybe I can intercede for him, especially if she's not after me. And so he decided to go into the marketplace and actually look for the Lady of Death. And as he was walking between the alleys of the stalls, he spotted her. And the fact that she was looking the other way, was clearly not hunting him, made him feel all the more secure in walking up to her, clearing his throat and saying, "Excuse me, but, madame?" And she turned and she looked at him and said, "Yes? I was wondering, my servant was in the marketplace and he said that you pointed at him today. And I wanted to know why it was that you were threatening him." And the Angel of Death shook her head and said, "Ah, I was not threatening him. I was just surprised to see him here, when, after all, I have an appointment with him this very evening in the town of Arad."
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. Journeys are centrally important in Judaism. The act of leaving and heading out into the great unknown is crucial for my people. At some level, the proper theme song for Jews seems like it ought to be, "On the road again, I can't wait to get back on the road again." Repeatedly in Jewish tradition, great leaders, or even the whole of our people, head out in the wilderness to seek God, make a new life somewhere else. It happened first with Abraham, father of our people, in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha. Happens two generations later to Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel and is in most ways the founder of our people. And it happens again with Moses, who flees his country of birth in Egypt to find God in the Sinai Desert, and then leaves there to go back to Egypt, and finally takes the whole people of Israel out of slavery in this week's portion of B'Shalach, and puts us on the path of redemption and freedom and covenant. It keeps happening throughout Jewish history. The idea of the wandering Jew has ideological relevance as well as pathos. In particular, though, Jewish religious tradition has a peculiar perspective on the events of the Exodus, which reached their climax in the Torah portion of B'Shalach this week. To put it simply, we raise up the escape from slavery and heading out into the Sinai wilderness to the highest conceivable historical status, far beyond what seems to be appropriate. It's true that the drama of Jewish history begins with the exodus from Egypt and the escape from Pharaoh on the shore of the sea, and it's logical to focus on that, but there's more to it. In effect, our central Jewish story is about transition, travel, hitting the road. This becomes the core narrative of all Judaism. To paraphrase Descartes, we left, therefore we are. Our essential nature as a people seems to be formed by this exodus. The notion that we have to leave, to go out on the road in order to find ourselves, still has some currency. Although we lack the direct intervention of God that seems to have been an advantage for our ancestors, there still is something to the need to get out and go in order to understand who we are and what matters to us. Even today, that journey of moral discovery has relevance and meaning. To celebrate that Exodus experience at the heart of our Jewish identity, here's a song of praise to God from the Hallel service chanted on Passover when we celebrate this Exodus. Hodu l'Adonai ki tov, give thanks to God, because God is good and God's kindness endures forever. From Cantor Alberto Mizrahi. Hodu l'Adonai ki Cantor Abe Mizrahi singing Hodu Ladonai Ki Tov, praising God, in this week of reading about the Exodus. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this morning is on the theme of Exodus, leaving, going outward to a new reality, abandoning all we have known. Marge Piercy's poem, Magid. The courage to let go of the door, the handle. The courage to shed the familiar walls whose very stains and leaks are comfortable as the little molds of the upper arm. Stains that recall a feast, a child's naughtiness, a loud blattering storm that slapped the roof hard pouring through. The courage to abandon graves dug into the hill, the small bones of children, and the brittle bones of the old whose marrow hunger had stolen. The courage to desert the tree planted and only begun to bear, the riverside where promises were shaped, the street where empty pots were broken. The courage to leave the place whose language you learned as early as your own, whose customs, however dangerous or demeaning, bind you like a halter you have learned to pull inside to move your load. The land fertile with the blood spilled on it, the roads mapped and annotated for survival. The courage to walk out of the pain that is known into the pain that cannot be imagined, mapless, going barefoot without a canteen into the desert. We honor those who let go of everything but freedom, who ran, who revolted, who fought, who became other by saving themselves. The poem Magid by Marge Piercy. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk more with our guest, Professor Jonathan Boyarin, leading scholar of changing Jewish identity in the 21st century, when we come back on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a unique and delightful evening of great wines, a wonderful meal, and the most unusual and pleasant holiday celebration of the year. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is coming to Temple Emmanuel on Friday night, January 29th at 6:15 p.m. Tu B'Shvat celebrates the natural world and God's role in making it both beautiful and fertile. The Temple Emmanuel Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder, led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, features stories, songs, special fruits and nuts, a delicious Shabbat dinner, and an array of outstanding wines from our top kosher wineries, Yarden, Dalton, Herzog, and Barkin, in our taste-off of the best Israeli wines. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is followed by an all-music service for Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, at 7:30 p.m., and features Bill Gray Lectureship speaker, Professor Jonathan Boyarin, explaining the kaleidoscope of Jewish generations. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder and Sabbath of Song, Friday, January 29th, is a fabulous way to enjoy Friday night at Temple Emmanuel. It all makes for a terrific evening. Call 327-4501 to sign up for the Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder at Temple Emmanuel on Friday night, January 29th. Call 327-4501 to sign up for one of the best nights of the year.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In beleaguered Haiti, Israeli medical teams have drawn favorable attention for their efficiency, competence, and promptness, as well as their ability to actually heal people. Within hours after the quake, complete Israeli medical units were on their way with highly sophisticated medical imaging equipment, doctors, nurses, technicians, all fully self-sufficient. Shortly after landing in Haiti, they went to work, and they have been saving lives and limbs every hour of every day, all with a minimum of fuss. As one Israeli doctor, a colonel, said in a featured piece on the NBC Nightly News, "We are taught that if we save one life, we are saving the world. We save the world every hour. Feels good." That quotation, of course, is from the Talmud. And in a setting of horror and disaster, it gives us pride to know that the first response from Israel was generous, immediate, and practical. One earthquake survivor in Port-au-Prince, whose son was born in an Israeli field hospital, actually named him Israel in gratitude. In other news from Haiti, 8 Israelis are among the missing there, and an unknown number of Jews from elsewhere around the world, including some from the United States, said against the massive horror of perhaps tens of thousands of dead, this is a small number, but a part of the tragedy nonetheless. Incidentally, the first Jew to land on Haiti was a secret Jew, Luis de Torres, Christopher Columbus' interpreter and navigator, who landed with Columbus in 1492. Long Jewish history, although not a deep one there. In Germany, a historic joint session of the Israeli cabinet and the German government met in Berlin, once the heart of the Nazi regime, highlighting the two nations' strong and deep ties today. The session was originally scheduled for late November, but was postponed because of a brief illness of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The joint session between Israel and Germany and the bilateral talks that followed, as well as a visit to Berlin's Holocaust Memorial, have been conducted with a great deal of fanfare. The key issue discussed was the nuclearization of Iran. Netanyahu and German Chancellor Angela Merkel issued similar statements warning Iran that it will face new sanctions if it doesn't change course on its nuclear program. Germany is probably Israel's strongest ally in Europe now, and while it's startling to see Israel's ministers in Berlin, it is a powerful reaffirmation of just how much things really can change in this world. When Pope Benedict XVI visited Rome's main synagogue last week, the sparring between the Pope and Jewish leaders over Pope Pius XII's role in the Holocaust grabbed the headlines, but the emotion-charged visit, which took place exactly a week ago right now, held broad significance as Jewish leaders and the German-born pontiff sought to mend strained relations and reaffirm a commitment to Christian-Jewish dialogue. Israeli Foreign Minister Sylvan Shalom attended. Despite a dramatic history, said Rome's chief rabbi, Ricardo de Segni, speaking to a packed sanctuary in front of the ornate ark, it's a beautiful ark if you've been to the Roman synagogue, despite a dramatic history, the unresolved problems and the misunderstandings, it is our shared visions and common goals that should be given pride of place. The image of respect and friendship that emanates from this encounter must be an example for all those who are watching. Pope Benedict provoked criticism by pardoning a Holocaust-denying bishop last year and by moving Pope Pius XII, the Pope during the Holocaust, who has been sharply criticized for cooperating too closely with the Nazis and failing to speak out against the Shoah, moving him closer to sainthood. The visit was thus boycotted by the head of the Rabbinical Assembly of Italy. Nonetheless, I think the papal visit to the synagogue in Rome is another important act, affirming the healing and healthy dialogue between the Catholic Church today and the Jewish world. Well, love may mean never having to say you're sorry, but eventually it means having to say goodbye. Eric Segal, author of the popular novel and movie screenplay Love Story, you remember that? Died last week after a 25-year battle with Parkinson's disease. He was 72. Born in New York, Eric Segal was the son of a rabbi and studied foreign languages, including Hebrew, from a young age. He had a bachelor's degree from Harvard, 1958, master's degree in classics, and a doctorate in comparative literature. In 1972, 2 years after the movie Love Story became a box office hit and a pop icon, and Eric Segal became a favorite of the talk show circuit, the author and scholar was denied tenure at Yale, where he was a classics professor. Among Segal's students at Yale were George W. Bush and Al Gore. Segal admitted that the main Love Story character, Oliver, was modeled after Al Gore and his Harvard roommate, actor Tommy Lee Jones. Didn't know that. Segal wrote several screenplays, including earning a writing credit for the Beatles film Yellow Submarine. I can't believe they actually had an author on that film. In any case, after leaving Yale, continued to publish best-selling novels as well as research works on ancient literature. Segal eventually settled in England. He was a fellow at Oxford University's Wolfson College. Guess wasn't quite good enough for Yale, but okay for Oxford. Eric Segal ran 10 miles a day, competed in the Boston Marathon until he was diagnosed with Parkinson's in the mid-80s. You know, I still can't get over the fact that Ali McGraw telling Ryan O'Neill love means never having to say you're sorry will be the lasting legacy of Eric Segal, but it will. And finally, in The Simpsons' huge anniversary, 20 decades of TV, one of the subjects they tackled, if that's correct, was Jewish intermarriage. Boy, we are just everywhere, aren't we? And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jews This Morning, Professor Jonathan Boyar and the Leonard and Toby Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Modern Jewish Thought at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was previously at Kansas, one of the most distinguished ethnographers of Judaism in today's world. He has published a number of books, including his sort of groundbreaking first book as co-editor from A Ruined Garden, The Memorial Books of Polish Jewry, Polish Jews in Paris, The Ethnography of Memory, The Politics of Jewish Memory, Thinking in Jewish. Has edited as well a number of books on Jewish identity and with his brother, Palestine and Jewish History and the Powers of Diaspora. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship of the diaspora and the diaspora identity to what it means to be Jewish today. Lots of Jews have thought of the diaspora as kind of a substitute for real Jewish life, yet it's been real Jewish life for 1,800, 1,900 years.
First of all, however it happened and it probably a quirk of my birth order or my family history. The major associations, the major patterns and idioms that I have been affectively tied to, that have made me want to go ahead and make a career out of being and becoming a Jew, have been precisely diasporic, and more precisely the Yiddish and East European Jewish sensibility and idioms. And I'll go beyond that and say that working now within the academy in Jewish studies, one of the things that I find so exciting is the way that Jewish experience, with its combination of identity and hybridity, with its combination of persistence and contingency, is almost a model, or at least a very good analog for thinking through a whole host of other group identities that are commonly talked and thought of in the academy as diasporic today. So there's a larger transvaluation of the very notion of diaspora, not just with respect to Jews and Judaism.
Of course, the word diaspora means simply spread around, spread out into the world. Now that Jews connect to Israel. I realize this is always a controversial topic with you. I worked with a rabbi once who sort of saw the model that people had experienced as sort of a solar system model, you know, Israel with all the planets around it as the diaspora Jewish community. I don't think you'd buy that, would you?
Only if we take Israel not necessarily to mean the contemporary nation state since 1948, but the homeland as memory, ideal, and goal, and also the everyday interactions in the world in which we're living now. But I certainly don't see Jewishness outside the land and state of Israel as necessarily or in any existential way diminished or less whole or less fully formed than living Jewish in Israel.
When you think about what makes Jewish identity, which I assume you spend a good deal of time on, what do you think the crucial components are?
Oh, gosh, I guess I like to think of a set of loosely defined key foci that we could define in several ways. We could say Torah, practice, land, family, and engagements of sufficient weight with some or all of those make you Jewish. I tend to be very, very loose in my professional work and tend to err on the side of saying, as Gershom Scholem did, that what's Jewish is what Jews do. And I would say who's Jewish for my professional purpose is who says they're Jewish.
You're working on a manuscript on Abraham Joshua Heschel, the late Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the really seminal figures of the 20th century in Jewish thought. What is that manuscript about, and how does it have relevance for today?
Oh, gosh, it's about the Rebbe of Kutsk. And to be precise, this is a translation of a book by Heschel about the Kutsk Rebbe. It's a big project because it's a big book. And the Kutsk, as I read him through Heschel, was sort of in the fourth generation of modern Hasidic Rebbes. And it was a moment when I guess the movement was almost ripe for a kind of reform. In any case, the Kutzker is not the sweet, world-affirming, Jew-embracing Baal Shem Tov type that we're familiar with. He was definitely a tough love Rebbe.
Big time.
Emphasized very strongly the need for endless struggle against self-delusion, and raised very high the principle of the search for truth, almost taking literally when we come to the end of reciting the Shema and say the words, Hashem Elokechem Emes, as if he were saying, the Lord your God is truth. So if you're searching for truth, that's the best way to get to God. But it's a very elitist and demanding form of Hasidism. And as I understand it, and as I think Heschel did as well, this is very much a modern philosophy. In fact, Heschel emphasizes the affinities between the Kutzker and Soren Kierkegaard.
We look forward to learning a great deal more if you live in southern Arizona from Jonathan Boyarin, who will be our Bill Gray Scholar in Residence at Temple Emmanuel this coming weekend. And you can learn more about that from the website templeemmanueltucson.org. Thank you so much, Jonathan. We look forward to learning with you and hearing from you again.
Thanks for the conversation.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. The premier Jewish educational event in southern Arizona is coming to Temple Emmanuel next week. Professor Jonathan Boyarin, Distinguished Professor of Jewish Thought at the University of North Carolina, will present the 2010 Rabbi Albert T. Bill Gray Lectureship Series at Temple Emmanuel and the University of Arizona from Thursday, January 28th through Sunday, January 30th. Dr. Boyarin will explore Jewish identity and the kaleidoscope of generations. On Thursday, January 28th at 7:30 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Dr. Boyarin will speak on the anthropology of Judaism. On Friday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m., he'll speak at Temple Emmanuel on Jewishness and the Kaleidoscope of Generations. Saturday, January 30th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch, he'll explore Hasidic modernity, radical introspection, and Jewish belief. Call 327-4501 for information on all three presentations. All the events in this terrific Temple Emmanuel Rabbi Albert T. Bill Gray Lectureship are free and open to the public, except the dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information and to find out more about Arizona's first synagogue. That's 327-4501.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Shai Ben Tekoa, a West Bank settler in Israel and a leading figure in the settlement movement. Promise it will be very interesting. Play out this morning on Too Jewish comes from the wonderful early Jewish music ensemble, the Boston Camerata. Adon Olam, from the end of the morning service in a Renaissance Baroque setting by Salomone Rossi, first and perhaps only great Jewish madrigal composer. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.